WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Itzhak Perlman, is perhaps the best-known and most popular classical violinist of his generation. He's reached a wide audience through his performances on public television, on shows ranging from great performances to Sesame Street. His new PBS special in the Great Performances series will air on many stations Sunday night. It features Perlman performing klezmer music with several of the bands at the forefront of today's klezmer revival. Klezmer music is a form of Jewish pop that is played at ceremonies and parties. It's a hybrid of traditional melodies from Eastern Europe and the sounds of jazz and vaudeville. Perlman grew up in Israel. His parents emigrated there from Poland in the early 30s as part of the Zionist movement. His extended family remained in Poland and perished in the Holocaust. Perlman's PBS Klezmer special has a companion CD called Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. From that CD, here he is with the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Itzhak Perlman, is this the first time you've played klezmer music?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a little surprised that it's the first time because I have not really, I've been living with it actually since I was born. You know, it's in Israel and so on. And then so it was, when somebody told me, how would you like to play it? I was a little, I almost asked myself, why didn't I do it before? It was something very, very, you know, very natural. Of course, I was a bit apprehensive because I've never played it. But once I started, you know, it took me about 2 or 3 minutes to get in the groove, and the rest was just a lot of fun.
So now that you've learned to play klezmer music, yeah. What's different from what you're used to?
I don't know if I've learned yet, but I'm happy.
We've been doing it anyway.
I'm happy that I can do a little bit of it. I suppose there are certain things, I don't know how you can call them in klezmer music. I know in jazz you call them licks, where everybody has a certain kind of way of doing things. In klezmer music, it's the same thing. In klezmer music, actually, there's one element that does not exist in any other kind of music, and it's called the krechts. Now, the krechts actually translated, it's a Jewish word, which means basically groan. I don't know if it means really groan. It's a groan with, this, you know, some things in Yiddish you can't really translate properly. But I think so the closest thing is a groan, maybe a sob. I think a sob and a groan together could be a good definition of what a krechts is. And it has to do with certain things that you do on the instrument. And if you, you know, you can play one phrase. You know, one of the interesting questions that I thought, you know, occurred during the time that I played was that a lot of these klezmer tunes and melodies and so on have origins of you know, Hungary or Romania, you know, Eastern Europe and so on. And you know, so I said to somebody, you know, if you play a Romanian tune, let's say, or what we call you know, what was associated with gypsy violin and so on, what would be the difference between, let's say, a gypsy tune and a Jewish tune if you play it the same? Because, you know, there is certainly a closeness to something like that. And they said, well, it would be the krechts, that in a gypsy tune you would not have that sob. You would have something else. You would have different slides, different shifts, and so on. While at the minute you do something like this in a Jewish tune, it would immediately give it a stamp. So it was, you know, for me it was a real education.
So technically, how do you get that sob out of the violin?
Oh, technically I can't describe, you know, you just touch one note before another. I mean, you know, if I, you know, it's a way that, you know, when you want to play one note, you know, there is always another note that you touch before you play that one. And that gives you that, you know, it's like a little, a little small little, it's, you know, I almost feel that it shouldn't be described, you know, it should just be heard.
The television show about klezmer music took you to some synagogues in Eastern Europe in which, in towns in which there are no Jews left anymore. What was that experience like for you?
Well, we were specifically in Krakow, and we were at the, basically at the Jewish quarter there, which was totally, you know, abandoned. There are about, I'm told about maybe at this moment, maybe 200 Jews left there out of about 75,000 at the height of its, you know, during the 40s and 30s, I suppose. The most incredible thing about it was that it was a ghost town, and that I suppose, luckily or unluckily, the synagogues, I suppose that's good, the synagogues were not destroyed. You know, there were about five or six synagogues that are still standing there, and another 19 houses of learning, you know, shtiebels, what they call them, where they used to study Talmud and etc. and everything else in school. And of course, the good thing about it is that you can see what it was like. The depressing thing about it was that it's minus the most important element, which is the population.
Right.
And so it was a kind of a bittersweet experience for us. We went to a they actually it's becoming a bit chic almost to do things Jewish there. You know, there was of course a klezmer festival in Krakow, where that's one of the reasons that we were there, because some of the groups gather there, and we play to a lot of to a lot of enthusiastic people there. We all gathered in a restaurant which was in the middle of the Jewish quarter, which served authentic Polish Jewish food that, you know, I would close my eyes and it would be like my mother used to make it, but yet it was not, you know, it was not Jewish. It was just sort of in the style. So it was very strange, you know, to go into a place like this and you see, you know, a menorah, Hanukkah menorah on the wall, and, you know, and things that look a little bit like home and so on. And yet it's almost like a make-believe.
Almost like a theme park rather than an actual cultural experience.
Exactly. And that, for me, it was very strange, very strange.
Let me play something from the new klezmer record, Itzhak Perlman, In the Fiddler's House. I think I'll play Hunger. Am I saying that right, by the klezmatic?
Hunger's fine. That's a nice, happy little tune there.
Do you want to say anything about it?
Well, yes, I can tell you one thing. I can tell you that this tune we recorded at 12 midnight. That was the first day we recorded that tune. So, you know, we were really into it, you know, but it was like, almost reminded me of, you know, when you hear some of those old jazz recordings where the guys don't start recording until like 12 or 1 in the morning, you know, and so on. This was done at the end of a very, very long session, and we were really going at it and so on. So you're listening to something that was done at the very, very end of session, and we were just very warmed up.
Thank you.
That's Itzhak Perlman with the Klezmatics from the new CD, Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. We'll talk more with Perlman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with violinist Itzhak Perlman. Now, I understand you were interested in the violin as young as 3 1/2.
Yes.
How were you exposed to classical music? Where did you hear it?
Radio. Just radio. That's all you heard there. At that time, there was the ratio of classical music to other kinds of music was a little, bigger. And so there was a lot of stuff that was going on there. I would say that at that time, overtures by Suppé and Rossini were what was considered pop music. and so I listened to a lot of, it was always on the radio. I didn't really have a chance to go to too many concerts at that time. But I do remember, actually, one incident where my mother wanted to take me to a recital that Isaac Stern was giving in Tel Aviv, and they wouldn't let me in because they felt I was too young. It was one of those first traumatic experiences having to do with trying to get into a concert hall, and not, they won't let me. So I remember that. My parents were very much aware that I was very interested in music. So that's how it went.
You weren't let in because they were afraid you'd cry in the middle of the concert?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They felt it was too young to have somebody 3 1/2 to just go to a grown-up concert.
When you were 4, you got polio.
Yes.
And spent, a lot of time in the hospital?
No, I spent about, I would say, maybe 6 weeks. That was, sort of from beginning to finish of the, whatever the disease was going through. And after about 6 weeks, I came back home, and then we went through a whole bunch of rehabilitation and things like that. By about 4 1/2, I was already all set, and towards 5, I started to play again.
You were very young. I mean, you might not have even had the words yet, the vocabulary yet, to describe what you were physically experiencing. Were you terrified during that period, or was the lack of knowledge that you had as a child useful in a way?
Well, yeah, I did not particularly, I felt that that was what happened, In other words, I was explained, that this particular, that polio makes you not be able to walk. So that was it. And then they said, because of that, you're going to have to be fit with leg braces. And I said, fine, and so on. And when you're a kid, you learn to adapt very easily. And I did. And the thing is that, of course, I had... I started to go to school, just regular school. My parents moved to a neighborhood where, school was close to our, to our apartment. And then, of course, music lessons and so on. So I proceeded with my life.
You were discovered in Israel by Ed Sullivan. What was he doing in Israel?
Ed Sullivan, of course, was the most incredible television person, because his show was, whatever was new, whatever was interesting, whatever was funny, whatever was unusual, he would have on his show. And one of the things, one of the ideas that he had at one point is to come to Israel and to choose Israeli people in different modes of performance to come to his show and to have a show just made out of Israeli acts, if you want to call it. So I was one of the acts. I was. They had on that show. I know that they held national auditions, and I was sort of lucky enough to get into the finals, if you want to call it that. And I played for him, and then he said, "Yes, I would like him to come." That show had like a dance troupe. They had a couple of duo pianists who played classical stuff. They had folk songs. They had folk singers. They even had a person who did shadows on a screen of famous political figures. He would do a shadow of Stalin. Can you imagine at that time doing a shadow of Stalin or Ben Gurion or somebody like that, and so on. So we had everybody there, and I was, doing my abbreviated version of the last movement of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Really abbreviated. I mean, is abbreviated the correct way?
Yeah.
Very short, 3 minutes. So that was it. That's the way I came, And then I appeared a couple of more times on the show at the same period of time.
So the first time you were in the U.S., it was to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes.
Did you have any idea what the show was like? It was such an institution for Americans, but you were from another country.
Yeah. Well, we heard in Israel that was the show. And the thing is that anything American that you heard in Israel at that time was, something very, very exciting. But we said that this guy has the show on television, that millions of people are watching it and so on. So it was very exciting.
So you came to New York for the Ed Sullivan Show, and then you stayed. You got a scholarship at Juilliard. Your parents came over from Israel.
Yes.
To be with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your father ended up folding shirts in a laundry in Manhattan.
Well,
no,
my father did a lot of things. He didn't just know. He didn't, he had stuff that he learned, in order to go into the States. He started to do things like making wigs. He would work in a print shop. He did any job that he could get so that, he could help support, helps us being supported and so on. So he did a lot of the stuff.
When you were starting your performance tour, was access a problem for you? You walk with canes and braces. And
yeah.
America, I think, has come a long way.
Tell you, we've come a long way, but it's still not very good. I mean, you still, if you go to, just recently played in a place where I had to go down one flight of stairs. So it all depends, it all depends on the architect, it depends on the concert hall, and I'm talking about new concert halls too that are still problematic, not to mention the old ones. It's so funny, the excuse is there, the minute something is not great, we said it's not quite accessible, they said, this was built 10 years ago, or this was built 20 years ago, or this was built 30 years ago, as though there were no people with disabilities 30 years ago. So, people are certainly more aware of what the problems are, but it's still for me a crapshoot. That sometimes you go to a city and it might be okay, and sometimes it might not. So, people have a very, very wrong way of thinking about what access means. People think that access means to get into a place, period. Whether you get into a place through a freight elevator or through a garbage elevator is not the point. Just get to the place. For me, access has to do also with getting into a place with dignity and getting into a place with where other people can get in the same place with you. In other words, not to have to go specially to a special entrance or to have a guard open the door for you while if you ring them, 20 minutes in advance to make sure to make arrangements to let you in. For me, that's not access. For me, that's inconvenience. Access is that if I want to get into a place, whether it's backstage or for the front, then I can just do it. And, I suppose there are more places that are conscientious of that. There are, definitely. But still, we have a very long way to go.
This year was the year of your 50th birthday, and EMI, your record label, has celebrated it with tours, the release of several new recordings. What has this year been like for you?
What has that been like for me? I'm so happy it's over. People don't let me, every now and then, happy birthday. I said, wait a minute, it's been already almost 3 months. What are we doing? But, I suppose the older you get, the longer your birthdays become. I suppose when you have like a milestone birthdays like 50 or 60, I think they probably last at least a year. So I think that until 51, I'm going to hear about this 50th birthday.
Was the 50th birthday significant for you personally in any way? Do big numbers, round number birthdays mean anything to you one way or another?
Not really. I suppose it's a little depressing, but I get over it. I'm feeling good, and hopefully I'm playing good. So I feel good. I feel good about it. I'm happy with what's going on around me, my family, and so on. So I'm happy.
One last question. What have you been listening to lately at home or in your car?
Oh, lately? Oh, well, a lot of Beatles, obviously. what's been going on right now? Uh-huh. It's like a new revolution. So I've been listening to that. And just the normal things. You know, I always have this mixture of classical and golden oldies, which I still love to listen to, you know, from my days of listening to these things. I'm talking about 57, 58, 59, and into the 60s and so on. So I listen to a lot of that. And, of course, the fresh air. Use that as a commercial.
Well, gee, I want to thank you so much for talking with
us. My pleasure.
Itzhak Perlman's Klezmer special will be shown on many PBS stations Sunday night as part of the Great Performances series. His companion CD is called Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.